This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Lone Survivor, the eyewitness account of Operation Red Wing and the lost heroes of SEAL Team 10. Written by Marcus Luttrell and Patrick Robinson. And read by Kevin T. Collins.
Prologue. Would this ever become easier? House to house, freeway to freeway, state to state? Not so far. And here I was again, behind the wheel of a hired SUV, driving along another main street past the shops and the gas station, this time in a windswept little town on Long Island, New York, South Shore, down by the long Atlantic beaches. Winter was coming. The skies were platinum. The whitecaps rolled in beneath dark, lowering clouds. So utterly appropriate, because this time was going to be worse than the others. A whole lot worse. We all stepped out of the vehicle into a chill November day, the remains of the fall leaves swirling around our feet. No one wanted to lead the way, none of the five guys who accompanied me. And for a few moments we just stood there, like a group of mailmen on their break. The house was just a few yards down the street, and in a sense I'd been there before, in Southern California, Northern California, and Nevada. In the next few days I still had to visit Washington and Virginia Beach, and so many things would always be precisely the same. There would be the familiar, devastated sadness, the kind of pain that wells up when young men are cut down in their prime, the same hollow feeling in each of the homes, the same uncontrollable tears. The same feeling of desolation, of brave people trying to be brave, lives which had uniformly been shot to pieces. Inconsolable. Sorrowful. As before, I was the bearer of the terrible news, as if no one knew the truth until I arrived, so many weeks and months after so many funerals. And for me, this small gathering in Patchogue, Long Island, was gonna be the worst. I tried to get a hold of myself. But again in my mind I heard that terrible, terrible scream, the same one that awakens me, bullying its way into my solitary dreams night after night, the confirmation of guilt, the endless guilt of the survivor.
Help me, Marcus. Please help me.
It was a desperate appeal in the mountains of a foreign land. It was a scream cried out in the echoing high canyons of one of the loneliest places on earth. It was the nearly unrecognizable cry of a mortally wounded creature, and it was a plea I could not answer. I can't forget it, because it was made by one of the finest people I ever met, a man who happened to be my best friend. All the visits had been bad. Dan's sister and wife propping each other up, Eric's father, an admiral, alone with his grief, James's fiancée and father, Axe's wife and family friends, Shane's shattered mother in Las Vegas. They were all terrible, but this one would be worse. I finally led the way through the blowing leaves out into the cold, strange street, and along to the little house with its tiny garden, the grass uncut these days. But the lights of an illuminated American flag were still right there, in the front window. They were the lights of a patriot, and they still shone defiantly, just as if he were still here. Mikey would have liked that. We all stopped for a few moments, and then we climbed the little flight of steps and knocked on the door. She was pretty, the lady who answered the door, long dark hair, her eyes already brimming with tears. His mother. She knew I'd been the last person to see him alive, and she stared up at me with a look of such profound sadness it damn near broke me in half, and said quietly, "Thank you for coming." I somehow replied, "It's because of your son that I'm standing here." As we all walked inside, I looked straight at the hall table, and on it was a large framed photograph of a man looking straight at me, half grinning. There was Mikey, all over again, and I could hear his mom saying, "He didn't suffer, did he? Please tell me he didn't suffer." I had to wipe the sleeve of my jacket across my eyes before I answered that, but I did answer. "No, Maureen, he didn't. He died instantly." I had told her what she'd asked me to tell her. That kind of tactical response was turning out to be essential equipment for the lone survivor. I tried to tell her of her son's unbending courage, his will, his iron control, and as I'd come to expect, she seemed as if she had not yet accepted anything, not until I related it. I was the essential bearer of the final bad news. In the course of the next hour, we tried to talk like adults, but it was too difficult. There was so much that could have been said, and so much that would never be said, and no amount of backup from my three buddies, plus the New York City firemen and policemen who accompanied us, made much difference. But this was a journey I had to complete. I had promised myself I would do it, no matter what it took, because I knew what it would mean to each and every one of them. The sharing of personal anguish with someone who was there, house to house, grief to grief. I considered it my sworn duty, but that did not make it any easier. Maureen hugged us all as we left. I nodded formally to the photograph of my best friend, and we walked down that sad little path to the street. By any standards, it was an expensive, long, and melancholy journey across the United States of America, paid for by the organization for which I work. Like me, like all of us, they understand. And as with many big corporations which have a dedicated workforce, you can tell a lot about them by their corporate philosophy, their written constitution, if you like. It's the piece of writing which defines their employees and their standards. I have for several years tried to base my life on the opening paragraph. In times of uncertainty, there is a special breed of warrior ready to answer our nation's call. A common man with uncommon desire to succeed. Forged by adversity, he stands alongside America's finest special operations forces to serve his country and the American people, and to protect their way of life. I am that man. My name is Marcus Luttrell. I'm a United States Navy SEAL, team leader, SDV Team 1, Alpha Platoon. Like every other SEAL, I'm trained in weapons, demolition, and unarmed combat. I'm a sniper, and I'm the platoon medic. But most of all, I'm an American. And when the bell sounds, I will come out fighting for my country and for my teammates, if necessary, to the death. And that's not just because the SEALs trained me to do so. It's because I'm willing to do so. I'm a patriot, and I fight with the Lone Star of Texas on my right arm and another Texas flag over my heart. For me, defeat is unthinkable. Mikey died in the summer of 2005, fighting shoulder to shoulder with me in the high country of northeast Afghanistan. He was the best officer I ever knew, an iron-souled warrior of colossal, almost unbelievable courage in the face of the enemy. Two who would believe it were my other buddies who also fought and died up there. That's Danny and Axe, two American heroes, two towering figures in a fighting force where valor is a common virtue. Their lives stand as a testimony to the central paragraph of the philosophy of the U.S. Navy SEALs. I will never quit. I persevere and thrive on adversity. My nation expects me to be physically harder and mentally stronger than my enemies. If knocked down, I will get back up, every time. I will draw on every remaining ounce of strength to protect my teammates and to accomplish our mission. I am never out of the fight. I'm telling this story because of my three buddies, Mikey, Danny, and Axe. If I don't tell it, no one will ever understand the indomitable courage under fire of those three Americans. And that would be the biggest tragedy of all. To Afghanistan, in a flying warehouse. This was payback time for the World Trade Center. We were coming after the guys who did it. If not the actual guys, then their blood brothers. The lunatics who still wished us dead and might try it again. Goodbyes tend to be curt among Navy SEALs. A quick back slap, friendly bear hug, no one uttering what we're all thinking. Here we go again, guys, going to war. To another trouble spot, another half-assed enemy willing to try their luck against us. They must be out of their minds. It's a SEAL thing. Our unspoken invincibility, the silent code of the elite warriors of the U.S. Armed Forces. Big, fast, highly trained guys, armed to the teeth, expert in unarmed combat, so stealthy, no one ever hears us coming. SEALs are masters of strategy, professional marksmen with rifles, artists with machine guns, and if necessary, pretty handy with knives. In general terms, we believe there are very few of the world's problems we could not solve with high explosive or a well-aimed bullet. We operate on sea, air, and land. That's where we got our name. U.S. Navy SEALs, underwater, on the water, or out of the water. And where we were going, it was likely to be strictly out of the water. Way out of the water. 10,000 feet up some treeless moonscape of a mountain range in one of the loneliest and sometimes most lawless places in the world. Afghanistan. I remember it like it was yesterday. Someone pulling open the door to our barracks room, the light spilling out into the warm, dark night of Bahrain, this strange desert kingdom. The six of us dressed in our light combat gear, flat desert khakis with Oakley assault boots, stepped outside into a light, warm breeze. It was March 2005, not yet hotter than hell, but still unusually warm. Bahrain stands on the 26-degree north line of latitude. That's more than 400 miles to the south of Baghdad, and that's hot. Our particular unit was situated on the south side of the capital city of Manama, way up in the northeast corner of the island. This meant we had to be transported right through the middle of town to the U.S. airbase on Muharraq Island for all flights to and from Bahrain. That little journey, maybe 5 miles, took us through a city that felt much as we did. The locals didn't love us either. There was a kind of sullen look to them, as if they were sick to death of having the American military around them. In fact, there were districts in Manama known as Black Flag areas, where tradesmen, shopkeepers, and private citizens hung black flags outside their properties to signify Americans are not welcome. There are undercurrents of hatred all over the Arab world, and we knew there were many sympathizers with the Muslim extremist fanatics of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. The black flags worked. We stayed well clear of those places. Awaiting us at the U.S. airbase was the huge C-130 Hercules, a giant turboprop freighter. It's one of the noisiest aircraft in the stratosphere, a big, echoing steel cave specifically designed to carry heavy-duty freight, not sensitive, delicate, poetic conversationalists such as ourselves. We loaded and stowed our essential equipment, heavy weps, machine guns, M4 rifles, Sig Sauer 9mm pistols, pig stickers, combat knives, ammunition belts, grenades, medical and communication gear. A couple of the guys slung up hammocks made of thick netting. Business class this wasn't, but frogs don't travel light, and they don't expect comfort. The flight crew checked we were all strapped in, and then those thunderous Boeing engines roared. Jesus, the noise was unbelievable. The whole aircraft shook and rumbled as we charged down the runway, taken off to the southwest, directly into the desert wind which gusted out of the mainland Arabian Peninsula. There were no other passengers on board, just the flight crew and, in the rear, us. Headed out to do God's work on behalf of the U.S. government and our commander-in-chief, President George W. Bush. We stayed south, flying high over the friendly coastal deserts of the United Arab Emirates, north of the burning sands of the Rub al-Khali, the empty quarter. Astern of us lay the fevered cauldrons of loathing in Iraq and nearby Kuwait, places where I had previously served. Below us were the more friendly, enlightened desert kingdoms of the world's coming natural gas capital, Qatar, the oil-sodden emirate of Abu Dhabi, the gleaming modern high-rises of Dubai, and then farther east, the craggy coastline of Oman. None of us were especially sad to leave Bahrain. We never felt at home there. And somehow, as we climbed into the dark skies, we felt we were leaving behind all that was god-awful in the northern reaches of the Gulf and embarking on a brand new mission, one that we understood. In Baghdad, we were up against an enemy we often could not see and were obliged to get out there and find. And when we found him, we scarcely knew who he was. Al-Qaeda or Taliban, Shiite or Sunni, Iraqi or foreign, a freedom fighter for Saddam or an insurgent fighting for some kind of a different god from our own. A god who somehow sanctioned murder of innocent civilians. A god who'd effectively booted the Ten Commandments over the touchline and out of play. We were leaving behind a place which was systematically tearing itself apart and heading for a place full of wild mountain men who were hell-bent on tearing us apart. Afghanistan. Those mountains up in the northeast, the western end of the mighty range of the Hindu Kush, were the very same mountains where the Taliban had sheltered the lunatics of Al-Qaeda, shielded the crazed followers of Osama bin Laden while they plotted the attacks on the World Trade Center in New York on 9/11. They may not have been the precise same guys who planned 9/11, but they were most certainly their descendants, their heirs, their followers, and our coming task was to stop them, right there in those mountains, by whatever means necessary. The guys who traveled from Bahrain with me were remarkably diverse, even by SEAL standards. There was Sergeant Matthew Jean Axelson, not yet 30, a petty officer from California. Axe, as I called him, was a quiet man, 6'4", with piercing blue eyes and curly hair. He was smart and the best Trivial Pursuit player I ever saw. In the teams, he was always professional. In combat, he was a supreme athlete, swift, violent, brutal, if necessary. His family never knew that side of him. They saw only the calm, cheerful Navy man who could undoubtedly have been a professional golfer, a guy who loved a laugh and a cold beer. Then there was my best friend, Lieutenant Michael Patrick Murphy, also not yet 30, an honors graduate from Penn State, a hockey player, accepted by several law schools before he turned the rudder hard over and changed course for the United States Navy. Mikey was an inveterate reader. His favorite book was Stephen Pressfield's Gates of Fire, the story of the immortal stand of the Spartans at Thermopylae. We started our careers as SEALs at the same time, and we were probably flung together by a shared devotion to the smart-ass remark. He was also the finest officer I ever met, a natural leader, a really terrific SEAL who never, ever bossed anyone around. And he simply would not tolerate any other high-ranking officer, commissioned or non-commissioned, reaming out one of his guys. He insisted the buck stopped with him. He always took the hit himself. If a reprimand was due, he accepted the blame. Sitting opposite me in the Hercules was Senior Chief Daniel Richard Healy, another awesome Navy SEAL, 6'3", 37, married to Norminda, father of 7 children. He was born in New Hampshire and joined the Navy in 1990, advancing to serve in the SEAL teams and learning near fluent Russian. Danny and I served in the same team, SDV Team 1, for 3 years. He was a little older than most of us and referred to us as his kids, as if he didn't have enough. He guarded his flock assiduously, researched every mission with complete thoroughness, gathered the intel, checked the maps, charts, photographs, all reconnaissance. Also, he paid attention to the upcoming missions and made sure his kids were always in the front line. That's the place we were trained for, the place we liked to go. Somewhere up above us, rock and roll blasting in his headset, was Petty Officer Second Class Shane Patton, 22-year-old surfer and skateboarder originally from Las Vegas, Nevada, my protege. As the primary communications operator, I had Shane as my number two. I once walked into the comm center and he was trying to order a leopard skin coat on the internet. "What the hell do you want that for?" I asked. "It's just so cool, man," he replied, terminating further discussion. Shane, like a lot of those beach gods, was hugely laid back. In a comms operator, that quality is damn near priceless. If there's a firefight going on and Shane's back at HQ manning the radio, you're listening to one ultra-calm, very measured SEAL communicator. The sixth member of our group was James Sue, a 28-year-old native of Chicago who was raised in South Florida. James had been with SDV Team 1 for 3 years before we left for Afghanistan, and during that time he became one of the best-liked guys on the base. In our platoon, James was right up there with Axe and Shane as a SEAL of high intelligence and supreme reliability under fire. It took us almost 3 hours to reach the Gulf of Oman. We'd cut south of the Strait of Hormuz, staying well away from the superhighway of world oil and gas tankers moving to and from the massive loading docks of the Gulf of Iran. As we headed out toward the open ocean, it really was goodbye. For me, at least, to the Arabian Peninsula and the seething Islamic states at the north end of the Gulf, Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, and Iran, that had dominated my life and thoughts for the past couple of years, especially Iraq. I'd first arrived there to join Team 5 back on April 14th, 2003. It was 1 week after the U.S. forces launched their opening bombardment against the city, trying to nail Saddam before the war really started. The Brits had just taken Basra. On the same day I arrived, U.S. Marines took Tikrit, Saddam's hometown, and a few hours later the Pentagon announced that major combat had concluded, none of which had the slightest bearing on our mission, which was to help root out and, if necessary, destroy what little opposition was left, and then help with the search for weapons of mass destruction. 48 hours later, on April 17th, U.S. forces captured Saddam's half-brother, the infamous Barzan Ibrahim al-Tikriti. I was one of 146,000 American and coalition troops in there, under the command of General Tommy Franks. It was my first experience of close-quarter combat. It was the place where I learned the finer points of my trade. We worked usually in a very small unit of 4 SEALs, out on our own. This kind of close-quarter recon is the most dangerous job of all. It's lonely and often dull, and fraught with peril should we be discovered. Sometimes with a particularly valuable terrorist leader, we might go in and get him, trying to yank him out of there alive. Brutal. No mercy. We'd go in fast, driving into the most dangerous districts in the city, screaming through the streets in Humvees, or even fast-roping in from helicopters if necessary. We'd advance, city block by city block, moving carefully through the dark, ready for someone to open fire on us from a window, a building, somewhere on the opposite side of the street, even a tower. It happened all the time. Sometimes we returned fire, always to much more deadly effect than our enemy could manage. And when we reached our objective, we'd either go in with sledgehammers and a hoolie, that's a kind of crowbar that will rip a door right off its hinges, or we'd wrap the demo around the lock and blast that sucker straight in. We always made certain the blast was aimed inward, just in case someone was waiting behind the door with an AK-47. It's hard to survive when a door comes straight at you at 100 miles an hour from point-blank range. Occasionally, if we had an element of doubt about the strength of the opposition behind that door, we would throw in a few flash crashes, which do not explode and knock down walls or anything, but do unleash a series of very loud, almost deafening bangs accompanied by searing white flashes. Very disorienting for our enemy. Right then, our lead man would head the charge inside the building, which was always a shock for the residents. Even if we had not used the flash crashes, they'd wake up real quick to face a group of big, masked men, their machine guns leveled, shouting, daring anyone to make a move. Although these city houses were mostly two-story, Iraqis tend to sleep downstairs, all of them crowded together in the living room. We'd look for the ringleader, the guy who knew where the explosives were stored, the guy who had access to the bomb-making kit or the weapons that would be aimed straight at American soldiers. We'd get some light in there and march him directly to the window so the guys outside with the intel could compare his face with photographs. Identification was usually swift, and interrogation would begin. We would question the ringleader, demanding he inform us where his terrorist cell was operating. Fired on from the rooftops, watching for car bombs, we learned to fight like terrorists. Night after night, moving like wild animals through the streets and villages. There's no other way to beat a terrorist. You must fight like him, or he will surely kill you. On May 1st, 2003, President Bush announced the military phase of the war was over. 4 days later, it was revealed Saddam and his son had heisted $1 billion in cash from the central bank. Around that time, with the search for weapons of mass destruction still underway, we were detailed to the gigantic Lake Buhayrat Athathar, where supposedly a large cache had been hidden by Saddam. Now, this was a major stretch of water, nearly 50 miles long and in some places 30 miles wide, set on a flat, verdant plain between the Euphrates and the Tigris, south of Tikrit. There's a huge dam at one end, and we were stationed just to the south at a place named Hit. Seemed fitting. So we jocked up and combed the deep, clear waters of that lake for about a week. Every inch of it. We found nothing except for a bicycle tire and an old ladder. As the weeks went by, the weather grew hotter, sometimes hitting 115 degrees Fahrenheit. We kept going, working away through the nights. There were times when it all seemed to grow calmer, and then on July 4th, a taped voice, which Al Jazeera television said was Saddam, urged everyone to join the resistance and fight the U.S. occupation to the death. We thought that was kind of stupid. Because we weren't trying to occupy anything. We were just trying to stop these crazy pricks from blowing up and wiping out the civilian population of the country we had just liberated from one of the biggest bastards in history. Didn't much matter what we thought. The very next day, a serious bomb went off at a graduation ceremony for the new Iraqi police class, trained by the United States. 7 new cops were killed and 70 more were wounded. We continued our operations, looking for the key insurgents, forcing or bribing the information out of them. But it already seemed their recruiting numbers were limitless. No matter how many we ran to ground, there were always more. Al-Qaeda received a severe blow to its morale on July 22nd, when Saddam's sons, Uday and Qusay, who were at least as evil as their dad, were finally nailed at a house in Mosul. I'm not allowed to speak of this highly classified operation, save to mention the pair of them were killed when U.S. Special Forces flattened the entire building. Their deaths were entirely due to the fact that a couple of their devoted, loyal comrades, full of pride in their fight for freedom, betrayed them. For money. Just as they would later betray Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Despite all our efforts, the suicide bombers just continued. On August 29th, a massive car bomb exploded outside a Shiite mosque in Najaf and killed 80 people, including the revered and greatly loved Shiite leader Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim. In our opinion, this was rapidly getting out of hand. It seemed no matter how many of these nuts we rounded up, there were always more young men quite happy to take that shortcut into the arms of Allah. By now, late August, the question of the missing WMDs was growing more urgent. Hans Blix, the United Nations chief weapons inspector, had retired from public life, and the U.S. armed forces were now keeping a careful watch. In our view, the question of whether Saddam Hussein had biological and chemical weapons was answered. Of course he did. He used them in Halabja, right? I guess by now the issue in the minds of the American public was, did he have a nuclear weapon, an atom bomb? But of course that is not the most significant question. The one that counts is, did he have a nuclear program? We knew the American intelligence agencies believed he had such a program, that somewhere in this vast country, it's bigger than Germany, nearly as big as Texas, there were centrifuges trying to manufacture the world's most dangerous substance. That was all the information we had, but we knew what to look for, and we would most certainly have recognized it if we had found it. Did Saddam actually own the completed article, a finely tuned atomic bomb or missile? Probably not. No one ever thought he did. But as former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld once remarked, what do you want to do? Leave him there till he does? Looking back during our long journey in the C-130 to Afghanistan, I was more acutely aware of a growing problem which faces U.S. forces on active duty in theaters of war all over the world. For me, it began in Iraq, the first murmurings from the liberal part of the USA that we were somehow in the wrong, brutal killers bullying other countries. That we who put our lives on the line for our nation at the behest of our government should somehow be charged with murder for shooting our enemy. It's been an insidious progression. The criticisms of the U.S. armed forces from politicians and from the liberal media, which knows nothing of combat, nothing of our training, and nothing of the mortal dangers we face out there on the front line. Each of the 6 of us in that aircraft en route to Afghanistan had constantly in the back of our minds the ever-intrusive rules of engagement. These are drawn up for us to follow by some politician sitting in some distant committee room in Washington, D.C. And that's a very long way from the battlefield, where a sniper's bullet can blast your head, where the slightest mistake can cost your life, where you need to kill your enemy before he kills you. And those ROE are very specific. We may not open fire until we're fired upon or have positively identified our enemy and have proof of his intentions. Now that's all very gallant. But how about a group of U.S. soldiers who've been on patrol for several days, have been fired upon, have dodged rocket-propelled grenades and homemade bombs, have sustained casualties, and who are very nearly exhausted and maybe slightly scared? How about when a bunch of guys wearing colored towels around their heads and brandishing AK-47s come charging over the horizon straight toward you? Do you wait for them to start killing your team, or do you mow the bastards down before they get a chance to do so? From the standpoint of the U.S. combat soldier, Ranger, SEAL, Green Beret, or whatever, those rules of engagement represent a very serious conundrum. We understand we must obey them because they happen to come under the laws of the country we are sworn to serve, but they represent a danger to us. They undermine our confidence on the battlefield in the fight against world terror. Worse yet, they make us concerned, disheartened, and sometimes hesitant. I can say from first-hand experience that those rules of engagement cost the lives of 3 of the finest U.S. Navy SEALs who have ever served. I'm not saying that given the serious situation, those elite American warriors might not have died a little later, but they would not have died right then, and in my view would almost certainly have been alive today. I'm hopeful that one day soon the U.S. government will learn that we can be trusted. We know about bad guys, what they do, and often who they are. The politicians have chosen to send us into battle, and that's our trade. We do what's necessary. And in my view, once those politicians have elected to send us out to do what 99.9% of the country would be terrified to undertake, they should get the hell out of the way and stay there. I'm not a political person, and as a Navy SEAL, I'm sworn to defend my country and carry out the wishes of my commander-in-chief, the President of the United States, whoever he may be, Republican or Democrat. I am a patriot. I fight for the USA and for my home state of Texas. I simply do not want to see some of the best young men in the country hesitating to join the elite branches of the U.S. Armed Services because they're afraid they might be accused of war crimes by their own side just for attacking the enemy. Baby SEALs and big old gators. The C-130 roared on, heading slightly more northerly now up toward the coast of Baluchistan, which stretches 470 miles along the northern shoreline of the Arabian Sea, and commands strategically the inward and outward oil lanes to the Persian Gulf. No nation, not the Turks, the Tatars, the Persians, the Arabs, the Hindus, or the Brits, has ever completely conquered Baluchistan, which is part of Pakistan. Those tribesmen even held off Genghis Khan, and his guys were the Navy SEALs of the 13th century. Baluchistan, its endless mountains a safe haven for so many fleeing Al-Qaeda recruits and exiled Taliban fighters, currently provides shelter for up to 6,000 of these potential terrorists. I was pleased when the air crew finally told us we were in Afghanistan airspace. I fell asleep somewhere over the Registan Desert. I cannot remember my dreams, but I expect they were of home. Home for us is a small ranch out in the piney woods of East Texas, near Sam Houston National Forest. We live down a long, red dirt road in a lonely part of the country, close by another two or three ranches, one of which our adjoining neighbor is about 4,000 times bigger than ours, and sometimes makes us seem a whole lot bigger than we are. I have a similar effect on my identical twin brother, Morgan. He's about 7 minutes older than I am, around the same size, 6 feet 5 inches, 230 pounds. Somehow I've always been regarded as the baby of the family. Morgan's a Navy SEAL as well, a little behind me in rank because I joined first, but he still assumes a loose command whenever we're together. Anyway, there's two or three houses on our Texas property, the main one being a single-story stone ranch surrounded by a large country garden, which contains one little plantation for corn and another couple for vegetables. All around us, just about as far as you can see in any direction, there's pasture, studded with huge oak trees and grazing animals. It's a peaceful place for a God-fearing family. Right from kids, Morgan and I were brought up to believe in the Lord. We weren't compelled to go to church or anything, and to this day, the family are not churchgoers. In fact, I'm the only one who does go to church on a somewhat regular basis. On Sunday mornings when I'm home, I drive over to the Catholic church where people know me. I was not baptized a Catholic, but it suits me. Its beliefs and doctrines sit easily with me. Since I was young, I've always been able to recite the 23rd Psalm and several others from beginning to end. Down home in our quiet backwoods area, it looks like an untroubled life. There are a few minor irritants, most of those being snakes. However, Dad taught us to deal with them long ago, especially the coral snakes and those copperhead vipers. There's also rattlesnakes, eastern diamondbacks, and king snakes, which eat the others. In the local lake, you can find the occasional water moccasin, and he is one mean little son of a bitch. He'll chase you, and while I don't much like him, I'm not scared of him. Morgan goes after them as a sport, likes to hustle them up, keep them alert. A mile or so up the road from us, there's a mighty herd of Texas longhorns. Beyond the house, there's a half dozen paddocks for my mom's horses, some of them belonging to her, others boarders from other people. People send horses to her for her near mystical power to bring sick or weak animals back to full fighting form. No one knows how she does it. She's plainly a horse whisperer, but she has some special ways of feeding them, including, for a certain type of ailing racehorse, some kind of seaweed concoction she swears to God can turn a cowpony into secretariat. My mom's a seventh-generation Texan, although she did once immigrate to New York City. Around here, that's like moving to Shanghai, but Mom has always been a rather glamorous blonde, and she wanted to make a career as an air stewardess. Didn't last long, though. She was back in the big country of East Texas real quick, raising horses. Like all of us, she feels Texas is a part of her spirit. I will come back to live here when I'm finished in the military, and I intend, sometime, to die here. So how does a farm boy from the backwoods of East Texas come to be made a petty officer first class and a team leader in the U.S. Navy SEALs? The short explanation is probably talent, but I don't have any more of that than the next guy. In fact, my natural-born assets are very average. I'm pretty big, which was an accident of birth. I'm pretty strong, because a lot of other people took a lot of trouble training me. And I'm unbelievably determined, because when you're as naturally ungifted as I am, you have to keep driving forward, right? I'll outwork anyone. I'll just go on and on until the dust clears. Then I'm usually the only one left standing. I was born in Houston, but raised up near the Oklahoma border. My parents, David and Holly Luttrell, owned a fair-sized horse farm, about 1,200 acres at one time. We had 125 head up there, mostly thoroughbreds and quarter horses. My mom ran the breeding programs, and Dad took charge of the racing and sales operation. Morgan and I were brought up with horses, feeding, watering, cleaning out the barns, riding. We worked the ranch, mended fences, swinging sledgehammers when we were about 9 years old. We loaded the bales into the loft, worked like adults from a young age. Dad insisted on that. At the time, Texas itself was in a boom-time hog heaven. Out in West Texas, where the oil drillers and everyone surrounding them were becoming multimillionaires, the price of oil went up 800% between 1973 and 1981. I was born in 1975 before that wave even started to crest, and I have to say the Luttrell family was riding high. It was nothing for my dad to breed a good-looking horse from a $5,000 stallion and sell the yearling for $40,000. He did it all the time, and my mom was a pure genius at improving a horse, buying it cheap and devoting months of tender loving care and brilliant feeding to produce a young runner worth eight times what she paid. And breeding horses was precisely the right line to be in. Horses were right up there with Rolex watches, Rolls Royces, Learjets, Gulfstream Ones, palaces rather than regular houses, and boats. Damn great boats. Office space was at a premium all over the state, and massive new high-rise blocks were under construction. Retail spending was at an all-time high. Race horses? Beautiful. Give me six fast ones, Mr. Luttrell. That way I'll win some races. That oil money just washed right off, and people were making fortunes in anything that smacked of luxury. Anything to feed the egos of the oil guys who were spending and borrowing money at a rate never seen before or since. It wasn't anything for banks to make loans of more than $100 million to oil explorers and producers. At one time, there were 4,500 oil rigs running in the USA, most of them in Texas. Credit? That was easy. Banks would lend you $1 million without batting an eye. The crash, when it came, was caused by the oil embargo and the Iranian Revolution, when the Ayatollah took over from the Shah. The key to it was geopolitical, and Texas could only stand and watch helplessly as the oil glut manifested itself and the price per barrel began to slide downward to an ultimate low of around $9. That was in 1986, when I was not quite 10. In the meantime, the giant First National Bank of Midland, Texas, collapsed, judged insolvent by government financial inspectors. That was one huge bank to go belly up, and the ripple effect was statewide. An era of reckless spending and investing was over. Guys building palaces were forced to sell at a loss. You couldn't give away a luxury boat, and Rolls-Royce dealers darn near went out of business. Along with the commercial giants felled by the oil crash went the horse farm of David and Holly Luttrell. Hard-running colts and mares, which Dad had valued at $35,000 to $40,000, were suddenly worth $5,000, less than they cost to raise. My family lost everything, including our house. I cannot describe how poor we were during the time Morgan and I were trying to get through college. I had four jobs to pay tuition and board and make my truck payment. I was the lifeguard in the college pool, and I worked with Morgan on construction, landscaping, cutting grass, and yard work. In the evening, I was a bouncer in a rough local bar full of redneck cowboys. And I was still starving, trying to feed myself on about $20 a week. One time, I guess we were around 21, Morgan snapped his leg playing baseball, sliding into second. When they got him to the hospital, Morgan just told them we didn't have any money. Eventually, the surgeon agreed to operate and set the leg on some kind of long-term credit. But the anesthetist would not administer anything to Morgan without payment. No one's tougher than my brother. And he eventually said, fine, I don't need anesthetic. Set the leg without it. I can take the pain. The surgeon was aghast and told Morgan he could not possibly have such an operation without anesthesia. But Morgan stuck to his guns. Doc, I don't have any money. Fix my leg and I'll handle the pain. Well, no one was crazy about that, especially the surgeon. But then Jason Miller, a college buddy of Morgan's, turned up, saw that he was in absolute agony, and gave him every last dollar of his savings to pay the anesthetist, at which point they put Morgan back together. When we were young, working the horses, my dad was very, very tough on us. He considered that good grades were everything, bad ones were simply unacceptable. I once got a C in conduct, and he beat me with a saddle girth. I know he was doing it for our own good, trying to instill discipline in his sons, which would serve them well in later life. He insisted on politeness and hard work, and he didn't let up even when we were all broke. Dad was the son of an Arkansas woodsman, another amazingly tough character, and he brought that stand-on-your-own-feet ruggedness into our lives at the earliest opportunity. We were always out in the woods, in rough country, in the East Texas pines, the red oaks, and the sweet gum trees. Dad taught us to shoot straight at the age of 7, bought us a .22 rifle and nylon 66. We could hit a moving Miller High Life beer can from 150 yards. He taught us what you could eat and what you couldn't. He showed us how to build a shelter, taught us how to fish. He even taught us how to rope and kill a wild boar. At home on any of the ranches, Dad showed us how to plant and grow corn and potatoes, vegetables and carrots. A lot of times when we were really poor, we just about lived on that. But perhaps most important of all, he taught us to swim. Dad himself was an all-American swimmer, and this really mattered to him. He was superb in the water, and he made me that good. In almost everything, Morgan is naturally better than I am. He's very gifted as a runner, a fighter, a marksman, a navigator on land or water. He always sails through his exams, whereas I have to slog it out, studying, practicing, trying to be the first man in and last man out. Morgan does not have to strive. He was honor man after his Seal Bud S class, voted for by his peers. I knew he would be before he even started. There's only one discipline at which he can't beat me. I'm faster in the water, and I have the edge underwater. He knows it, though he might not admit it. There was a huge lake near where we lived, and that's where Dad trained us. All through the long Texas summers we were out there, swimming, racing, diving, practicing. We were just like fish, the way Dad wanted it. He spent months teaching us to dive, deep, first on our own, then with our scuba gear on. We were good, and people would pay us to try and retrieve keys and valuables thrown into deep water. During this time, we had the occasional brush with passing alligators, but one of my great Texas friends, Trey Baker, showed us how to deal with them. I wrestled with one once and was pretty glad when that sucker decided he'd had enough and took off for calmer waters. But to this day, my brother loves to wrestle alligators, just for fun. He is, of course, crazy. But we sometimes take an old flat-bottom boat fishing in the lake, and one of those big old gators will come sliding up alongside the boat. Morgan makes a quick assessment. Nostrils about 8 or 9 inches from his eyes, so he's 8 or 9 feet long. Morgan executes a ramrod straight, low-angle dive right on top of the gator, clamping its jaws shut with his fists. Then he twists it and turns it, gets on its back, all the while holding those huge jaws tight shut and laughing at the panic-stricken beast of the deep. After a few minutes, they both get fed up with it, and Morgan lets it go. I always think this is the most dangerous part, but I never saw a gator who felt like having another go at Morgan. They always just turn around and swim away from the area. He only misjudged it once, and his hand bears a line of alligator teeth scars. You know, I think Dad always wanted us to be Navy SEALs. He was forever telling us about those elite warriors, the stuff they did and what they stood for. In his opinion, they were all that is best in the American male. Courage, patriotism, strength, determination, refusal to accept defeat, brains, expertise in all that they did. I was about 12 when I realized beyond doubt that I was going to become a Navy SEAL. I understood the brutality of the training, the level of fitness required, and the need for super skills in the water. Dad had told us of the importance of marksmanship. SEALs need to be at home in rough country, able to survive, live in the jungle if necessary. We were already good at that. By the age of 12, Morgan and I were like a couple of wild animals, easily able to live off the land. But deep down I knew there was something more required to make it into the world's top combat teams. And that was a level of fitness and strength that could only be attained by those who actively sought it. You always have to strive. In our part of East Texas, there are a lot of past and present Special Forces guys. Quiet, understated Iron Men. Most of them unsung heroes except among their families. But they don't serve in the U.S. Armed Forces for personal recognition or glory. They do it because deep in their granite souls they feel a slight shiver when they see Old Glory fluttering above them on the parade square. The hairs on the back of their necks stand up when these men hear the national anthem of the United States. When the president walks out to the strains of a U.S. military band's Hail to the Chief, there's a moment of solemnity for each and every one of them, for our president, our country, and what our country has meant to the world and the many people who never had a chance without America. And many such men way down there in East Texas were willing to give up their time for absolutely no reward to show kids what it takes to become a SEAL, a Ranger, or a Green Beret. The one we all knew about was a former Green Beret sergeant who lived close by. His name was Billy Shelton. Billy had a glittering army career in combat with the Green Berets in Vietnam and later serving on a government SWAT team. He was one of the toughest men I ever met, and one afternoon just before my 15th birthday, I plucked up my courage and went to his house to ask if he could train me to become a Navy SEAL. He was eating his lunch at the time, came to the door still chewing. He was a bull of a man, rippling muscles, fair skin, not carrying 1 ounce of fat. To my eyes, he looked like he could have choke-slammed a rhino. I made my hesitant request, and he just looked me up and down and said, "Right here, 4, tomorrow afternoon." Then he shut the door in my face. Billy did not hold an exercise class. He operated a full pre-SEAL training program for teenagers. Over the years, he had us in the gym pumping iron, hauling the torture machine, the ergometer, pounding the roads, driving our bodies, sweating and straining. "I'm gonna break you down mentally and physically," he yelled at us. "Break you down, hear me? Then I'm gonna build you right back up as one fighting unit, so your mind and body are one. Understand me? I'm gonna put you through more pain than you've ever been in." Right about then, half the class ran for their lives rather than face this bulldog, this ex-Texas Tech tailback who could run like a Mack truck going downhill. He had the support of a local high school, which allowed him to use their gym free of charge to train future special forces from our part of the world. "I'm not your friend," he'd shout. "Not right here in this gym. I'm here to get you right. Fit, trained, and ready for the SEALs, or the Berets, or the Rangers. I'm not getting one dime from anyone to do this, and that's why you're gonna do it right, just so you don't waste my time. Because if any one of you fails to make the grade in the Special Forces, it will not be because you were too weak. Because that would mean I'd failed, and I'm gonna make sure that cannot happen, because right here, failure's not an option. I'm gonna get you right, all of you. Understand?" He'd take us on 12-mile runs, hauling concrete blocks till we nearly collapsed. Guys would have blood on the backs of their heads from the chafing of the blocks, and he never took his eyes off us, never tolerated idleness or lack of concentration. He just made us grind it out, taking it to the limit, every time. And he asked only for undying devotion to the cause, the discipline of a samurai warrior, and lungs like a pair of bagpipes. He was absolutely relentless, and he really loved Morgan and me, two of only 6 survivors in the class. Once when I came back from a tour of duty in Iraq, I went to see him after a couple of weeks easy living and mom's cooking, and he threw me out of the gym. "You're a goddamn fat, pitiful excuse for a SEAL, and I can't stand to look at you," he yelled. "Get out of my sight." Holy shit. I was out of there, ran down the stairs, and didn't dare go back until I'd dropped 8 pounds. No one around here argues with Billy Shelton. No Navy SEAL can operate without a high level of expertise in unarmed combat. Billy told me I'd need to take martial arts classes as soon as possible. And so all through grade school and college, I studied and learned that strange, rather mystical Asian skill. I worked at it for many years instead of becoming involved in other sports, and I attained all of my goals. Morgan says the real truth is I don't know my own strength and should be avoided at all times. By any standards, I had a head start in becoming a Navy SEAL. I was made aware of the task at a young age, and I had 2 strong engines driving me forward, my dad and Billy Shelton. Everything I learned beyond the schoolroom down from my early years seems to have directed me to Coronado. Back in the C-130, the 7-hour journey from Bahrain to the colossal peaks and canyons of the northern Hindu Kush seemed endless. In the weeks before our arrival, there had been widespread incidents of violence, confirming everyone's dread that the generally hated Taliban was once more on the rise and a serious threat to the new government of Afghanistan. Even with the support of 30,000 U.S. and NATO troops, President Hamid Karzai struggled to control the country anywhere outside of Kabul. The Taliban had been in prominence since 1994. Their original leader was a village clergyman named Mullah Muhammad Omar, a tough guy who lost his right eye fighting the occupying forces of the Soviet Union in the 1980s. By the mid-90s, the Taliban's prime targets in Afghanistan, before I showed up, were the feuding warlords who A, formed the Mujahideen, and B, threw the Soviets out of the country. The Taliban made two major promises which they would carry out once in power: to restore peace and security, and to enforce Sharia, or Islamic law. Afghans, weary of the Mujahideen's excesses and infighting, welcomed the Taliban, which enjoyed much early success, stamping out corruption, curbing lawlessness, and making the roads safe for commerce to flourish. By 1998, they were in control of almost 90% of the country and showed their true colors. They set up one of the most authoritarian administrations on Earth, one that tolerated no opposition to their hardline policies. Ancient Islamic punishments like public executions for convicted murderers and amputations at the wrist for those charged with theft were immediately introduced. I cannot even think about the penalty a rapist or an adulterer might anticipate. Television, music, sports, and cinema were banned, judged by the Taliban leaders to be frivolities. Girls aged 10 and above were forbidden to go to school. Working women were ordered to stay at home. Men were required to grow beards. Women had to wear the burqa. These religious policies earned universal notoriety as the Taliban strived to restore the Middle Ages in a nation longing to join the 21st century. But there was another issue which would bring about their destruction, and that was their role in playing host to Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda movement. In August 1998, Islamic fanatics bombed the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, killing more than 225 people. Washington immediately presented the Taliban leaders with a difficult choice: either expel bin Laden, who was held responsible for the bombings by the U.S. government, or face the consequences. The Taliban flatly refused to hand over their Saudi-born guest, who was providing them with heavy funding. President Bill Clinton ordered a missile attack on the main bin Laden training camp in southern Afghanistan, which failed to kill its leader. Then in 1999, the United States persuaded the UN Security Council to impose sanctions on Taliban-ruled Afghanistan. 2 years later, even harsher sanctions were put in place in another attempt to force the Taliban to hand over bin Laden. Nothing worked. Not sanctions, nor the denial of Afghanistan's UN seat. The Taliban were still in power, and they were still hiding Osama bin Laden, but their isolation, political and diplomatic, was becoming total. But the Taliban would not budge. The poor Afghan people realized too late what they had done, handed over the entire country to a group of bearded lunatics who were trying to inflict upon them nothing but stark human misery and who controlled every move they made under their brutal, repressive, draconian rule. The Taliban were so busy trying to enslave the citizens, they forgot about the necessity for food, and there was mass starvation. 1 million Afghans fled the country as refugees. All of this was understood by the West. Almost. But it took horrific shock, delivered in March 2001, to cause genuine international outrage. That was when the Taliban blasted sky-high the two monumental 6th-century statues of the Bamiyan Buddhas, one of them 180 feet high, the other 120 feet, carved out of a mountain in central Afghanistan. This was tantamount to blowing up the pyramids of Giza. The statues were hewn directly from sandstone cliffs right in Bamiyan, which is situated on the ancient Silk Road, the caravan route which linked the markets of China and Central Asia with those of Europe, the Middle East, and South Asia. It was also one of the revered Buddhist religious sites, dating back to the 2nd century and once home to hundreds of monks and many monasteries. The two statues were the largest standing Buddha carvings on Earth. And their summary destruction by the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan caused museum directors and curators all over the world to have about 4 hemorrhages apiece. The Taliban effectively told the whole lot of them to shove it. They were planning to destroy all the statues in Afghanistan on the grounds they were un-Islamic. The Bamiyan Buddhas were destroyed in accordance with Sharia law. Only Allah the Almighty deserves to be worshipped, not anyone or anything else. Wraps that up then, right? Praise Allah and pass the high explosive. But it took another explosion to provoke savage action against them. That took place on September 11th, the same year, and was the beginning of the end for the Taliban and bin Laden's al-Qaeda. Before the dust had settled on Lower Manhattan, the United States demanded the Taliban hand over bin Laden for masterminding the attack on U.S. soil. Again, the Taliban refused, perhaps not realizing that the new-ish U.S. President George W. Bush was a very different character from Bill Clinton. Less than 1 month later, on October 7th, the Americans, leading a small coalition force, unleashed an onslaught against Afghanistan that shook that area of the world to its foundations. U.S. military intelligence located all of the al-Qaeda camps in the mountains of the northeast part of the country, and the military let fly with one of the biggest aerial bombardments in modern warfare. It began with 50 cruise missiles, launched from U.S. warships and Royal Navy submarines. At the same time, long after dark in Afghanistan, 25 carrier-based aircraft and 15 land-based bombers took off and destroyed Taliban air defenses, communications infrastructure, and the airports at Kabul, Jalalabad, Kandahar, and Herat. The U.S. bombs blasted the big radar installations and obliterated the control tower in Kandahar. This was the city where Mullah Omar lived, and a Navy bomber managed to drop one dead in the middle of his backyard. That one-eyed old bastard escaped, though. The Taliban, its military headquarters now on fire, did own a somewhat insignificant airstrike capacity, just a few aircraft and helicopters, and the U.S. Air Force wiped that right out with smart bombs as a matter of routine. Navy bombers taken off from the carriers targeted the Taliban's other military hardware, heavy vehicles, tanks, and fuel dumps. Land-based B-1, B-2, and B-52 bombers were also in the air. The B-52s dropping dozens of 500-pound gravity bombs on al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in eastern Afghanistan, way up in the border mountains where we soon would be visiting. One of the prime U.S. objectives was the small inventory of surface-to-air missiles and shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles, stolen from either the Russians or the old Mujahideen. These were hard to locate, and various caches were removed by the tribesmen and hidden in the mountains. Hidden, sadly, for use another day. 1 hour after that nighttime bombardment began, the Northern Alliance opened fire with a battery of rockets from an airbase 25 miles north of Kabul. They aimed them straight at Taliban forces in the city. There were 5 thunderous explosions and all electric power was knocked out throughout the capital. But the United States never took its eye off the ball. The true objective was the total destruction of al-Qaeda and the leader who had engineered the infamous attack on the Twin Towers, the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century, as the president described it. And that meant a massive strike on the sinister network of caves and underground tunnels up in the mountains, where bin Laden made his headquarters. The cruise missiles had softened up the area, but that was only the start. The real heavyweight punch from the world's only superpower would come in the form of a gigantic bomb, the Blue 82B C-130, known as Commando Vault in Vietnam and now nicknamed Daisy Cutter. This is a high-altitude, 15,000-pound conventional bomb that needs to be delivered from the huge MC-130 aircraft because it's far too heavy for the bomb racks on any other attack aircraft. This thing is awesome. It was originally designed to create instant clearings for helicopter landings in the jungle. Its purpose in Afghanistan was as an anti-personnel weapon up in those caves. Its lethal radius is colossal, probably 900 feet. Its flash and sound is obvious from literally miles away. We can only imagine the crushing effect such a blast would have inside the caves where the al-Qaeda high command and senior leadership operated. Wouldn't have been too good even if you were standing in the middle of a field. But a cave? Jesus, that's brutal. That thing wiped out hundreds of the enemy at a time. In the fall of 2001, the Taliban and al-Qaeda were mostly fleeing the U.S. offensive or surrendering. In the subsequent years, they drifted together on the other side of the Pakistani border, reformed, and began their counteroffensive to retake Afghanistan. Somehow these hickory-tough tribesmen not only survived the onslaught of American bombing and escaped from the advancing Northern Alliance, but they also evaded one of the biggest manhunts in the history of warfare, as an increasingly frustrated United States moved heaven and earth to capture bin Laden, Mullah Omar, and the rest. While they undoubtedly lost many of their followers after a front-row view of what the American military could and would do, they began recruiting and training a brand new generation of supporters. And now they were back as an effective fighting army, launching guerrilla operations against the U.S.-led coalition forces only 4 years after they had nearly been annihilated. As we prepared for our final approach to Bagram, the Taliban were once again out there, killing aid workers and kidnapping foreign construction workers. Parts of eastern and southern Afghanistan have been officially designated unsafe due to increasingly daring Taliban attacks. I ought to mention the Pashtuns, the world's oldest living tribal group. There are about 42 million of them. 28